Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Six world powers, including the United States and Iran last week, unveiled what we now call a joint comprehensive plan of action regarding Iran's nuclear program. It's still just a framework. The final deal is due by the end of June. But even the framework has attracted plenty of criticism and support. Coming up, we'll get two points of view. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post, Ishan Tharoor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the so-called P5 plus one was first brought together in 2006. Some kind of agreement was reached in November 2013. Can you give us a sense of about the timeline here and what has happened in the last 9 years?
Well, it goes beyond that. It goes to around 2002, 2003, when we first had revelations of Iran's clandestine nuclear program. Talks at that point with the Bush administration failed, and in the interim, Iran's nuclear program grew considerably. With the election in 2013 of the more moderate Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, diplomacy once more got a chance. And the agreement that you mentioned in November kind of set the stage for further negotiations thereafter.
The Iranians and the American negotiators seem to be coming back with slightly different stories. Is there anything of concern there, or is it just what they're still shooting for that June deadline?
Well, I mean, they have to both play to their domestic constituencies. I think the joint statement was, I mean, most people have been rather impressed by the thoroughness of what emerged in the joint statement. Of course, a lot of deals have to, a lot of technicalities have to be ironed out. There are a lot of questions hanging around over Iran's capacity to enrich going forward, and over the thoroughness of inspection regimes that may come into place. Obviously, also both the Iranians and the Americans have hardline domestic constituencies that they have to appeal to and convince. And so you can look at the messaging in some capacity as a matter just of politics.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the deal with Iran. My guest is Ishan Tharoor. He is a foreign affairs reporter for The Washington Post. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. How has Iran's changing role in the region, in the wake of turmoil in Syria and Iraq, changed the negotiations?
They're taking place on different tracks. You know, what you're alluding to is Iran's very clear involvement in a whole set of conflicts around the Middle East, from Iraq's from the various political crises in Iraq to the unraveling of Syria to Lebanon's longstanding sectarian politics. Iran has skin in the game in all these places.
Mm-hmm.
But the nuclear deals, of course, the idea, I think, on the part of the international community is that any kind of rapprochement with the Iranian regime would help kind of calm down the wider regional picture. If Iran is brought into the fold, if its economy is opened up again, then the other tensions parallel to this elsewhere may be easier to resolve.
Some Arab states are in agreement with Israel when it comes to this deal. They're against it. They say Iran should not be trusted. What is the extent of the agreement between Israel and Gulf states such as, say, Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, there's no direct agreement because, you know, obviously that would be politically problematic. But yes, I think on the question of Iran, both Israel and the Saudis and a number of the Gulf states that go along with the Saudis see eye to eye. They view Iran as a particularly troublesome, if not existential, threat to the region, and are wary of an Iran that would have a nuclear weapon. I think what the White House is trying to persuade its allies in the Middle East is that they have the capacity to deter and contain Iran, and that an Iran that is more integrated and a more meaningfully integrated into the world economy, as well as more brought into line by diplomacy, is a better prospect than an Iran that is contained and antagonized by hardline politics.
And yet the deal has faced harsh criticism from Republicans. Here's what Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had to say on CBS's Face the Nation.
I think Congress will require any deal negotiated with the Iranians to come to the Congress for our review before we lift congressional sanctions. I don't mind giving the administration the time between now and June to put this deal together, because when you listen to the Iranians and Secretary Kerry, it's almost like you're talking to two different deals.
Yeah, you mentioned, Ishan, that that's really a function of politics on both sides. But other than that, what about it? What role will Congress play in getting this deal finalized?
It's a big question, and we'll see in the coming weeks how difficult it is for the White House to prevent any kind of congressional obstacle thrown up to the deal. What's important to keep in mind is that this is not just an American-Iranian negotiation. This is a negotiation that involves a bunch of international partners, and that a congressional act would undermine the U.S.'s commitments to its allies. Forget about any kind of agreement that it makes with Iran.
You wrote what was entitled A Step-by-Step Guide to What the Iran Agreement Actually Means, and you talked about the main metric bandied about when calculating how to prevent an Iranian atomic bomb, and it's called breakout time. And there's lots of differences of opinion about how important the breakout time really is. Can you talk about that?
Right. What breakout time is technically is the amount of time it would take Iran to produce enough enriched uranium at a certain level that could form one atomic weapon. The current estimate is roughly 2 to 3 months right now. What any prospective deal would achieve would be at least a year of breakout time. Now, obviously, there are a lot of people who think breakout time is a bit of a red herring. One argument is that Iran if Iran did seek to, you know, take the risk to produce a nuclear weapon, it would do so clandestinely in facilities we don't know about, mm-hmm. not facilities that are under international inspection and lock and key. The second argument also is that in history, no budding nuclear power has ever just produced one bomb. To produce a whole arsenal, and to produce a whole arsenal, Iran would need much more than what it has right now available to it.
And then also, as far as the regime of international inspections, this issue has been compared to what happened in Iraq when the same problem is. I mean, if it's being done in secret, what good are the inspections, and why couldn't they just make it difficult to inspect in the first place?
Well, it seems, what's already in place in Iran is quite efficient and quite thorough. Iran and the Iranians also, there's so much scrutiny on what they have right now that it'll be difficult for the Iranians, given their current facilities, to do very much without people knowing. The plan of the nuclear program, of any kind of nuclear deal, would make it very difficult for the Iranians to quote unquote cheat. What's going to happen, presumably under any kind of successful deal, would be a very clear set time frame under which inspectors are given incredible access to Iran's uranium stockpiles, to its storage facilities, to its various other nuclear facilities, and understandings that would maintain Iran's levels of centrifuges, that would also freeze any of its nuclear activities. Now, what the Iranians are saying right now is that none of this is actually on the cards, which is a problematic sort of concern for negotiators going forward.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the sanctions relief. There seems to be a mechanism by which the sanctions would automatically snap back in place should Iran and violate the terms of an agreement. But people are saying that snapping back things like banking sanctions and that kind of thing aren't as easy as they sound.
Right. I mean, this is complicated political economic stuff here. But when you have a regime of sanctions in place, there's a whole architecture to the way they're enforced. The other thing is that especially when it comes to the United Nations, snapping back sanctions there are disagreements among the permanent members of the United Nations over how to enforce this mechanism. Countries like Russia, for example, really care about the Security Council process and want to be able to reserve their right to use a veto. which obviously is very, very, very problematic if you want to be able to snap back sanctions effectively and quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, of course, the question of if you can snap back the sanctions, then who's going to want to proceed as if the sanctions are permanent? And it's a lot of risk involved in that. Iran can't be in favor of that.
No, of course not. And the sanctions have been, you know, it's clear that part of what we're seeing right now is Iran recognizing and the supreme leader recognizing that sanctions have really undermined the Iranian economy, that there's a tremendous public appetite for an end to this and for Iran to return out of its deepening isolation in the previous years.
What about Benjamin Netanyahu and his relationship with President Obama? How is that apparently disintegrating relationship affecting the negotiations going forward?
Well, I mean, to be totally frank, it's not really affecting the negotiations. I think the Israeli Prime Minister said his piece, especially last month in mm-hmm. Washington. But, you know, Israel is not a party to the negotiations. It is an important American ally, but it doesn't have a seat at the table. Obviously, it affects more the political discourse within the United States. But I think Netanyahu's used as much leverage as he can so far, and now, you know, is very much on the sidelines.
When the agreement came out the other day, a lot of people said they were surprised at how much detail there was. Were you surprised?
Indeed, yeah. I think at least judging from what we were told initially from communications from the United States side, there were very, very clear time frames set for the amount of time certain facilities would be, you know, frozen or converted into other other research sites. There were very clear levels articulated about the number of centrifuges Iran could use. There were very long-standing time frames put in place. You really could see the mechanics of a deal there.
And so this is supposed to be finalized by the end of June. What happens if it's not?
Well, that's the very big question. Presumably, there would be renewed attempts for negotiations thereafter, but you can expect a polarization of the conversation in both countries. This is a highly tense situation where the Iranians, the hardliners in Iran could say, look, this hasn't worked, and then this would also renew scrutiny on Iran's nuclear ambitions, and so we could see new rounds of sanctions. We could see other kinds of provocations in the region. We could see also a steady drumbeat towards more direct military action.
Yeah, I was going to. They say it's either or. I mean, this could lead if we don't deal with this now, there could be war. Why is that? Because the sanctions have been in place already, and things seem to have been stabilized. But Iran will just go forward and start producing, and other powers in the region will have to do something.
Well, there's a sense that you know, I think when diplomacy had failed in the past was when Iran made its greatest nuclear strides. So there's reason to expect that could happen, that the Iranians could, you know, attempt to either, you know, create further clandestine facilities or you know, continue their enrichment. But and then at the same time, you do have a government in Israel that is very keen for more direct action. So there are a whole bunch of actors in play who would like to see some kind of direct confrontation.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Ishan Tharoor.
Thank you very much.
Ishan Tharoor, he's a foreign affairs reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, two points of view on the Iranian deal. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Critics of a recently released framework regarding Iran's nuclear program have said that current economic sanctions on Iran should not be repealed. Some have called for tightening the sanctions. But the promise that the U.S. and European Union will eventually lift oil and banking sanctions on Iran has spurred celebrations in Tehran and a dip in the global price of oil last week. Coming up, we'll hear from a critic of the proposed deal. Joining us now is the director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Sean Kay. Welcome back, Sean.
Good morning.
So tell us, is the deal good or bad, and why?
Well, I think there's two ways to frame that. I mean, the deal itself is an architecture. There'll be continued negotiations to tighten up some of these elements through June. But, you know, we have a tight-knit international agreement that will be codified through the United Nations with deeply intrusive verification procedures through the International Atomic Energy Agency. And, you know, I would juxtapose that against this whole thing falling apart and there having been no deal in which Iran would be left unsupervised within a minimum of up to 3 months where it could produce maybe one nuclear weapon. So this is a major rollback of the Iranian nuclear efforts. It kicks some things down the road. There's going to be larger questions that need to come up, which is, you know, the degree of which Iran may be changing and evolving geopolitically in the region. But for the United States and its national security and the concerns of its allies, this is certainly a far better situation than we were in when this was left unchecked for a good decade or so during the 2000s.
Some have said that the question of a total lift of sanctions, which Iran wants, versus a phased-in lift of sanctions, which the U.S. and its negotiating partners want, is a question that fuels doubt among skeptics. To go all the way or maybe to just go halfway, and it doesn't seem like there's a good agreement on that.
Well, the deal is a little vague on the sequencing of sanctions. I heard you use the quote line, that sort of this will be, that they would be snapped back in place if there was cheating. That's a little unclear to me. I mean, would that be agreed to? That should, I think, personally speaking, be agreed to in advance rather than having to go back to the Security Council. Because then, like over the Iraq debates, you know, you get into a really risky, long debate over what is a violation, actually, you know, that's risky. But the problem is, again, politically, you know, both the Obama administration needs to sell this at home and the Iranians need to sell this at home. And their main objective has been the sanctions relief. So they want to be able to say that that's going to happen relatively quickly. Whereas I think as we see these processes kind of roll out into a tighter final agreement in June, I think it's pretty likely that the sanctions will be linked to deep commitments and evidence and verification of what Iran is up to.
How realistic do you think a scenario of snapbacks is, given that we're talking about banking sanctions? Are the bankers going to want to get involved if there's a threat of a snapback?
Well, you know, states care about their credibility. They care about credibility of these kind of architectures. They care about the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which Iran is a member of. But those are the weeds that I think still need to be worked out. But the actual specifics on what Iran is giving up via very significant inspection regime, that's a big deal. And Iran, you know, quite frankly, wasn't in a very strong negotiating position here, actually. So, the fact that we have these five, you know, UN Security Council members, along with the European Union, that's significant, you know, and I think it's important that that consensus hold going forward, and that especially in this negotiating period between now and June, this is the time to let these experts do their job and then take a hard look at the final deal, for example, in terms of the U.S. Congress down the road. And they could still keep the lever of even further sanctions, you know, locked in if there is evidence of cheating on this agreement.
What's prompted a change in U.S. foreign policy toward Iran? Previously, the U.S. has been party in these talks, but has rejected agreements. And in this round, France has been depicted as the country taking the harshest stance. What's going on?
Well, I mean, France is a lot closer to Iran, you know, and as is Israel, as are the Saudis. But the Saudis have given some preliminary support for this arrangement. There's going to be more consultation with the Gulf allies. The Israelis have their position, but I agree with your previous commentator that so far that hasn't caused any real problems diplomatically. Americans might wonder what's going on when you have a leader of a foreign country overtly saying he's going to work to dismantle our foreign policy priority. That's a separate debate. I think the answer to your question is a larger one, which is you know, do we talk to adversaries or not? You know, and mm-hmm. and in the 2000s, we took the view that there was an axis of evil. We're not going to negotiate with evil. During that period of time, North Korea blanked out on its nuclear commitments. We stopped giving them things we'd agreed to when we found out that there may be evidence of cheating. But we didn't keep talking to them, and they developed nuclear bombs. So the track record on not talking to these people is really bad. Actually, I mean, it's a really bad track record, both on North Korea and on Iran. Unfortunately, we've reached a political dialogue in Washington now where to point that, you know, to talk about the need to engage with adversaries is a tantamount to appeasement of some kind of aggression. But, you know, we hold the cards here. We have the capabilities. We have the consensus internationally. We're in a pretty strong position on this. And I think we just got a good deal that shows that there are payoffs to engaging. Whereas, as I said last time I was on your program, from 2000 to 2008 or so, mm-hmm. Iran went from zero centrifuges to about 6,000 mm-hmm. when we weren't talking to them. And now we're rolling basically all that back. It's going to be difficult for Iran. And now one place that is going to require a lot of attention is you know, the danger of a clandestine site that isn't seen or inspected. And so the U.S. and its allies are going to have to be intrusive in terms of using their intelligence. And you know, we did find evidence of some cheating on out of North Korea at the time, and so there was understandable concern. But rather than keep talking and working the process, we pulled the ball and said we're going home. And the end result was a North Korean nuclear weapon. So this larger question, do we talk to the Cubans? Do we talk to Putin? Do we talk to the Iranians? The track record of not talking to folks is really pretty weak. The track record of engagement, like opening the door to China, is pretty strong. And one of the big problems on the Iran question, I think, is this where this is really leading? Is this leading to some larger architecture for the U.S.-Iranian relationship? And I actually think that's an important larger element of the actual agreement, that it does create process. And arms control is a process, and it does create, you know, sort of the opportunity to reengage with each other. And, you know, there's plenty of reason to think there is a good case outcome here, where Iran is beginning to shift and we're beginning to open to them. But we certainly don't need to go, as I said before, down the trust road. What we need is to verify, and this regime is aggressive in terms of verification.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Iran deal. My guest right now, Sean Kay, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also join the conversation on our Facebook page. As far as Iran goes, what are the political hurdles there? We know that there's elected in 2013 a more moderate government now there, but what are the, who do they have to sell it to? What about the hawks there?
Well, you know, one of the details I'll be looking for in the coming months is how intrusive inspectors are able to have access to Iranian military facilities. You know, if that to me will be a really good indicator to the degree to which the Iranians have sold this internally, because I think that's where a lot of their debate is going to happen is access to high-end Iranian military bases with regard to inspections. But in terms of selling it domestically in Iran, I mean, there's a whole new generation of young Iranians who want nothing but to engage more in the world, and they're tired of living under the regime they live under, and they want to engage. You know, it's going to take time. There's going to have to be a process there. But I'm one who doesn't believe that the supreme leadership in Iran would have allowed this to go forward if they hadn't made some time ago a very basic decision that it's time to negotiate and get the best deal they can to get sanctions relief. Because the economy there is really suffering. And I think the people in charge have to be concerned, you know, that this large group of new generation of people who do want some change, that they're going to have to show some responsiveness to it. So there's a tension between showing that they got some benefit on the sanctions, but also showing that they're able to continue with research and development, what they call a peaceful nuclear program, and so on, and at the same time, keep them really, really pinned down in terms of the commitments on verification.
We mentioned earlier one of the biggest critics of the deal is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's what he had to say about the proposed framework.
Such a deal does not block Iran's path to the bomb, Such a deal paves Iran's path to the bomb. And it might very well spark a nuclear arms race throughout the Middle East, and it would greatly increase the risks of terrible war.
It sounds like almost Orwellian, the different views on how this plan is perceived. You're talking about how it could settle things down and calm down the region. He's saying this deal could lead to a nuclear arms race.
Well, there's been some qualifiers coming out of the Israeli position. They've now made sort of a list of things that they would like to see improved in the deal, and it's possible that some of those things can be met in the coming months. So I think he's staking out a hard position, but the diplomats are actually working on a different plane. So that position has been very consistent with him for a long time. Benjamin Netanyahu has also been consistently wrong on a lot of things, like advocating for invasion of Iraq and that kind of issue. But I disagree with him on the facts, actually. I mean, I think if you actually look at the if there was no deal right now, Iran could be 2 to 3 months away from a bomb. The 2013 freeze put that down the road, and the current agreement, literally, again, a country doesn't just get one nuclear bomb. They would want a whole program and facility. So if they could get even one bomb, the capacity under this agreement to do that is pretty much zero, actually. And the question is, what's the breakout time? And would we have enough time then to slap sanctions back in or even include military force? I would say one thing, by the way, and a colleague named Austin Long has done good work on this, but the fact that they're consolidating the remaining centrifuges into one facility as opposed to being spread out over a whole bunch of, almost a dozen ones around Iran, if you do need to use military force, this agreement actually makes it more likely it would succeed. But I disagree. I think that the facts of the matter are that if there were no agreement, which apparently is what the Prime Minister of Israel was arguing for, that would have paved the way to a very rapid Iranian breakout capacity. At bare minimum, this gives intrusive inspections in about a decade to see how it plays out. And these inspections work. They know what they're doing. They're very good at this sort of thing through the International Atomic Energy Agency.
We have an email from Bob. He writes, when the Non-Proliferation Treaty was developed, certain countries such as India and Pakistan were allowed to develop nuclear weapons and other nations such as Iran were not. How did the Non-Proliferation Treaty decide which countries could and could not develop nuclear weapons?
Those countries were not members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea was, but then quit the treaty before it be held accountable on it. Iran is a participant in it. And the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty basically says that states that have nuclear weapons will not purposely proliferate them to non-nuclear states, and those who sign the treaty that do not have nuclear weapons will not develop nuclear weapons programs, if necessary to be verified through inspections. And that's been going on for some time, and the difference is non-nuclear weapon states that are NPT members do have a right to develop peaceful nuclear energy. And so the problem here in many ways is how we see the regime of Iran, and I think that's a very understandable concern given the historical track record. And others, including Benjamin Netanyahu, would have liked to have seen this wrapped up into sort of larger issues that are also going on in the Middle East, including, for example, a recognition of Israel's right to exist. And I think he's every reason and right to push for that. I believe the diplomatic negotiators felt that these are other things that we should try to fill in down the road and stay focused on the nuclear issue as opposed to getting too entangled in the additional regional problem.
What does President Obama have to do to convince Congress on this accord?
I think he needs to work very closely with Senator Bob Corker. He's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's somebody who, as the New York Times profiles today, is very committed to bridge building. And he does want a mechanism for more leverage. And he wants Congress to play a role in this. Now, Congress doesn't really have a constitutional role. They have an oversight role. But this isn't a treaty that they would ratify. Rather, it's an international agreement, and there's tons of precedent for that. But, a durable – I mean, the senators are right that a durable agreement would have U.S. Senate backing. And so the president needs to cultivate that, I think. And the place to go for that is Senator Corker. And I think that there's probably some room for a respectful accord that would basically say, let's see how this, not to do any damage to diplomacy over the next 3 months, but then take a hard look at it and see, are there places where the Senate may choose to put in language, for example, about what the consequences of cheating and additional sanctions down the road. But if they were to put more sanctions on now, I think it's really important to recognize that this international coalition of the UN Security Council plus the European Union would be very much put at risk if we did that. And we would be the ones internationally seen as causing this to fail, and perhaps also that failure leading to a breakout potential on Iran nuclear weapons.
But the sanctions are congressional sanctions, right?
International through the UN on a wide range of issues, including missile technology, terrorism, and other things, too. And all those stay in place under this agreement. I think the proof in the pudding will be the sequencing of sanctions being lifted. The Iranians want them lifted quickly so they can show they got something. We want to keep those, I think, you know, sort of sequenced in a relatively slow way. As Iran proves its commitments, sanctions would be lifted. And that's still something that I think needs some more codification in the final agreement.
And can those kind of sanctions be doled out in a way that does prove beneficial to Iran immediately, but also gives them something to shoot for?
Well, sure. And you know, they're concerned, again, about their domestic economic situation. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. But you know, again, I think it goes back to this basic principle. Do we engage? Do we talk to people or not? You know, and back in the 60s and early 70s, we didn't want to talk to China, you know, and mm-hmm. Richard Nixon went to China and opened the door. And now that is at the core of the global economy today, and it was a pivotal element in ending the Cold War. Talking to Cuba, talking to Iran, you know, we may not always get the deal, but this is basic foreign policy, and something kind of broke down in the last decade where this idea that we talk to adversaries is somehow equivalent to Chamberlain appeasement, which is just not how international relations actually works, that sometimes there has to be compromise, and sometimes you get the best deal you can given the realities of the circumstance you're in. And at least looking at the inner workings of this deal with regard to where Iran was and where it will be once this is in place and verified is a good deal for the United States and its allies.
I remember back in 79, 80 going to college with students from Iran, and I remember what happened during the revolution. Could we ever go back to those days?
Pre-revolution. That's up to Iran,
okay.
I think. And they have major issues to address, but both domestically and in terms of what they're doing internationally. But you know, it's a gradual process. But you know, so I don't think we should overinflate, you know, what can come out of this. But for example, it's a small thing, maybe perhaps, and it didn't really even make the news here. But Iran let the president of the United States. Shouldn't it be a big deal, but they did. They allowed the President of the United States, unedited, to characterize this agreement on Iranian TV live.
Yeah.
You know, these are the kind of things that break down walls with time. So there's potential here. But really, at the end of the day, you know, if an agreement's going to stick, it'll stick even harder if we see some positive change out of Iran. And whether it's worth exploring that or not is sort of the existential question at play here.
Sean Kay, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to.
Sean Kay, he's director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. Conversation continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Six world powers, including the United States and Iran, last week unveiled what we now call a joint comprehensive plan of action regarding Iran's nuclear program. It's still just a framework. A final deal is due by the end of June. President Obama said last week that the only alternative to a deal with Iran is war. But is it an either or? Joining us now is Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation, James Phillips. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
President Obama has argued that opening up Iran to the global economy will help transform the country. Here's what he said to NPR's Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition.
I think that it's important for us to recognize that if, in fact, they're engaged in international business, and there are foreign investors, and their economy becomes more integrated with the world economy, then in many ways it makes it harder for them to engage in behaviors that are contrary to international norms.
James Phillips, what do you make of the tack of using international economic relationships to curb any country's more controversial activities, especially Iran's?
Well, it doesn't seem to have curbed China's activities in staking out claims in the South China Sea. The Communist Party is still firmly in power. And I think there's a little mirror imaging going on here. And if you talk to the Iranian people, yes, they want greater connections with the international society, and especially on the economy. Unfortunately, Iran is ruled by a revolutionary elite that fears a velvet revolution, and the supreme leader continually warns against this and against the temptations of the great Satan or the U.S. And he calls us the great Satan not just because he considers us evil, but because of the temptations of Western culture in leading young Iranians away from what the elite defines as the pure Islam. So I think the moderating influence of such an opening will be greatly reduced by the fact that the regime is going to circumscribe that opening to make sure that it still holds on to total power.
Our last guest, Sean Kay from Ohio Wesleyan University, said that the negotiations wouldn't be happening in any event if the Supreme Leader wasn't allowing them to happen.
Right. Very little happens in Iran that he doesn't approve. And I think the Supreme Leader does want the sanctions lifted, but he does not want better relations with the U.S. And he continually says that, this is restricted to the nuclear field. Iran is still going to try to export its revolution, as Ayatollah Khomeini commanded. Iran is still going to support terrorist and revolutionary groups around the Middle East, and that's not going to change. And, the big question is, will Iran actually implement any deal it signs?
You used the example of China to suggest that it's still pursuing, and it still has the same government and is pursuing its same ultimate goals. But it's also been used as an example of success in opening up connections with countries like that. You don't agree that China is an example of success on this score?
I don't think that the opening by itself is enough to displace a revolutionary regime from power. It has given China an incentive to restrain its hostility towards the U.S. for economic reasons, but it still is a bully in its own neighborhood, and it still represses the freedoms and human rights of its own people, and the Communist Party is still fully in charge. And I think that, the Obama administration is betting that this will be a transformational deal with Iran that will transform the regime somehow into a more placid, more status quo power. But everything the Iranians themselves are saying contradicts that.
U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, a nuclear physicist, yesterday described the emerging deal with Iran as a forever agreement that's built upon hard-nosed requirements. These are his words, in terms of limitations on what they can do at various timescales and on the access and transparency. What do you make of the idea of a forever agreement?
Well, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was also considered a forever agreement, and Iran signed that and has constantly violated it. And it's important to remember that these negotiations with Iran didn't start back in 2013 with the Obama administration. They started back in 2003 with the EU3, that's Britain, France, and Germany, reaching out to Iran. Iran reached a tentative deal, then walked away from it. In 2009, the Obama administration thought it had a deal with President Ahmadinejad, but that deal was vetoed by the Supreme Leader. The interim agreement signed in November 2013 required Iran to come clean on the IAEA investigation. That's the investigation by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it has stonewalled on that investigation. So it hasn't even delivered what it promised under the 2013 interim agreement. So I'd be very careful if I was Secretary of Energy Moniz. What was his name? I can't remember.
Moniz.
Mm-hmm. I'd be very careful about calling this a permanent agreement because, signing an agreement in principle with a regime that has no principles except for expanding its own power and exporting its revolution doesn't sound like a very permanent agreement to me.
What is there any kind of deal with Iran that could be a good deal for the United States?
I think there possibly were good deals if Iran had agreed to uproot more of its nuclear infrastructure. Under this present deal, it is not required to close any of its facilities, including facilities that were illegally built at Natanz and Fordo in Iraq, that were violations of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and that brought six UN Security Council resolutions down on Iran. If you look at the beginning negotiating positions of Iran and the P5 plus one, it's clear that the P5 plus one has sacrificed most of its positions to get where we are today, and Iran has given up very little. And it's still unclear whether there will be a deal on inspections or on lifting sanctions because the two fact sheets that were released following the most recent agreement or tentative parameter outline are conflicting. So we may not have a deal yet with Iran.
They have agreed. Do you expect Iran would ever agree to completely uproot its infrastructure? The idea is that could it still be developing nuclear power, you know, for nuclear power, could be developing for that, not for nuclear weapons.
But it doesn't need a plutonium reactor to get civilian nuclear power. It doesn't need to build a fortified base under a mountain on a Revolutionary Guard base to develop civilian nuclear power. It doesn't need to make a deal with a Pakistani nuclear smuggler, AQ Khan, to get civilian nuclear power. I think that's a fig leaf that Iran has used to disguise its nuclear weapons project.
And the sanctions, you don't think eliminating the sanctions or reducing the sanctions gradually over time is not a sweet enough deal for Iran? Some people think that the United States and its partners hold all the cards in this thing because of the sanctions.
Well, I think at the beginning, the U.S. and its partners did hold a lot of the cards. But unfortunately, I think the Obama administration gave Iran so much sanctions relief at the outset to get the interim deal, which Iran hasn't fully implemented, that it now lacks the leverage to get to where we need. And in the fact sheet the U.S. released, it said that sanctions would gradually be lifted in accordance with verified Iranian compliance. But in Iran's fact sheet, they say all the sanctions are coming off at once. So it's clear that the two sides still disagree on that.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Raymond in Johnstown, you're on the air. Hi, Raymond.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I'm just curious why we would actually help these people. I mean, I understand peace is a great thing, but to give them money and to help them economically, it just seems like the wrong thing to do. Knowing they ate terrorism, it just seems sad.
James Phillips.
Well, if if it was possible to negotiate a change in Iranian behavior, then I could see signing an agreement with Iran. But I just don't think that this regime will change its behavior, as it's, you know, repeatedly shown in reaching tentative agreements and then walking away from them. And, you know, even while it was negotiating with the U.S. Back in 2009, you know, suddenly the U.S. announced that it had discovered the Fordo facility, which was illegal, was built under a mountain, and was never declared by Iran. Now the administration is, you know, correctly pointing out that if, you know, theoretically, if Iran does behave, then the breakout time has been expanded from roughly 2 months to a year. That is the time that Iran would need to get enough uranium to build one nuclear weapon. However, the problem with Iran is not so much a breakout of declared facilities, but it's a sneak out of undeclared facilities. And, you know, who knows what a kind of Iranian-North Korean cooperation is going on. On North Korean soil. I mean, North Korea has provided Iran's ballistic missile force. It has cooperated in the nuclear field. It built a nuclear reactor in Syria in 2007 that the Israelis destroyed. The IAEA never saw it. U.S. intelligence never saw it. And Iran is believed to have financed that. So, you know, here they are trying to move stuff out of their own country. You know, we may have some kind of an airtight agreement about facilities inside Iran, assuming we can find them. But what about Iranian-North Korean nuclear cooperation?
Thank you, Raymond, for that call. We have an email from Hal in Worthington. He asks, to what extent are we obliged to stand by our negotiating partner's support for an agreement for the sake of international security?
Well, the U.S., it's true, this is not a direct U.S.-Iran bilateral negotiation solely. It's part of a broader framework. But the most difficult issues have been relegated to bilateral U.S.-Iranian talks, because the other allies, except for France, which actually has taken a harder line than the U.S. On Iranian nuclear issues. Except for France, the other countries have reason to be less concerned about Iran's nuclear program. Russia and China have extensive economic ties with Iran. Both have provided nuclear technology, and Russia sold a nuclear reactor. Both would stand to benefit much more than other countries by an opening to the international community and relief of sanctions. Germany was one of Iran's biggest trading partners before the sanctions, and a lot of German companies would love to get back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those countries would be less likely to want hard terms for this deal. So I think the U.S. has to be sure that its minimal security requirements are provided for.
And you're not convinced that the deal as it stands at this point does that?
No, there are very dangerous signs, I think. The fact that, you know, Iranian centrifuges will be mothballed, not dismantled.
But they will be consolidated.
They will be consolidated in the declared facilities. But, you know, we have given Iran's repeated building of undeclared facilities, you know, that's cold comfort.
Well, James Phillips, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
James Phillips, he's a senior research fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Hannah Palmer, Abdul Rahman Al-Ruweshan, and also video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.